It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin and other parts of the country are getting another dose of winter ahead of schedule. We'll find out what's going on and whether a return to fall is ever in the cards. First, Governor Tony Evers announced last month that he was ordering a special session of the legislature in order for lawmakers to debate and vote on two new gun control measures. One of them would have expanded background checks to include most private gun sales in Wisconsin. The other would have established preventive red flag laws. Neither measure had a chance to be discussed as GOP lawmakers quickly adjourned the sessions in both the Assembly and Senate. Our next guest joins us to talk about the special session and gun-related issues here in the state. Attorney General Josh Call joins us now. Attorney General Call, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
What is your reaction, Attorney General Call, to these very brief special sessions on gun control in the legislature?
Well, it was disappointing to see that the Republicans in the legislature chose once again to fail to take this issue up. There's no question that we have a need for some common sense gun safety measures. We have all seen what's happened with mass shootings around the country. And that includes here in Wisconsin. There was a mass shooting in Oak Creek. Last year in Middleton, there were four people injured in a workplace shooting. Suicide is a significant problem, and a lot of suicides are committed with firearms. And gun violence generally is a problem. And what I've been calling for, what the governor was calling for, and what others have called for, is that the legislature start taking this issue seriously and debate these issues, have some hearings, and let's see where we can find some compromise.
Republicans in the legislature have said they're willing to talk about gun measures. They're advancing legislation on suicide prevention, just that these two particular laws don't fit into their agenda. Is there a case to be made there that the governor should have looked for places of common ground when advancing gun control legislation?
These two issues are both issues on which there's a very broad bipartisan agreement. About four out of five Wisconsinites support expanding background checks and support a red flag law. That includes a majority of gun owners. It includes a majority of Republicans. There's really broad support for these measures. And the Republicans not only haven't taken a vote on them, they haven't held a hearing. They haven't had a debate on them. What I am asking for and what we've asked for and what the special sessions I think were designed to do was to encourage some debate on these issues. If Republicans think we shouldn't move forward on these issues, let's hear why that is and let's hear the alternatives for how we can work to address gun safety. But so far they've just pretended like this is an issue that doesn't exist and tried to avoid it.
Here's Assembly Speaker Robin Voss speaking on Thursday on the Assembly floor about public opinion on these issues.
Now, I also hear our governor, as he called for the special session, saying over and over this 80% number. I guess he's going to change his mind now on saying we should detain people who are here illegally, because 66% of the people in Wisconsin do believe that. So if we now run our entire political system by a poll taken by somebody else, that's not what I thought a republic actually was. So the governor, unfortunately, is focused on polls and politics, not policy and progress.
So don't make these decisions based on polls, Assembly Speaker Voss saying there, Attorney General Call.
Well, if these were bad policies, that would be a reasonable position to take. But the fact of the matter is that the Republicans are refusing to debate them. And the reason they're refusing to debate them is because they're good policy. We have background checks already for the vast majority of firearm sales in Wisconsin. The Department of Justice, where I am, conducts a lot of those, and the federal government conducts a lot of them. But there's a loophole in state law that allows anybody, including somebody who's prohibited from possessing a firearm because they've committed a felony or because they have a domestic violence restraining order against them, for example, to purchase a gun through a private sale, and that includes an online sale, and to get a gun without going through a background check. And that's what happened before the Ozana Spa shooting in Brookfield. So there was a clear example of that here in Wisconsin. Likewise, red flag laws have been adopted in several states, including Indiana and Florida. And those laws give law enforcement officers a tool when somebody engages in the kind of conduct that we see before some of these tragedies, where they make threats or perhaps where they indicate that they're suicidal. This gives law enforcement a tool to intervene and potentially save lives. That's the debate that Republicans are avoiding right now, and that's the debate that I think we should have.
Talking to Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call about gun legislation in Wisconsin. The governor called a special session of the legislature to deal with expanding background checks on firearm purchases and this red flag law. Lawmakers, Republican leaders of both chambers gaveled in and gaveled out without talking about those laws. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 on the idea of expanding background checks or red flag laws. I want to give one more listen to Assembly Speaker Voss talking here on Upfront with Adrian Peterson this weekend about the special session. He said Republicans here felt the laws being proposed were inherently anti-American. Here's a listen.
There are principles that we think are really important, and one of those is supporting the Second Amendment and making sure that if you're a legal gun owner, there should be no reason that you don't have the ability to have a firearm and defend yourselves. The very idea of a red flag is I have done nothing wrong, but because someone thinks I might, I have to surrender my weapon. That is not what America is about, so I can't see us ever compromising.
And that's a concern about red flag laws, that people can be deprived of a right, in this case, gun ownership, without due process. What do you say to that?
Well, first, on background checks, there's no Second Amendment argument whatsoever because, again, most firearm sales require a background check. This would just be expanding it so that we get rid of that loophole. On red flag laws, they have been challenged in three states, in Connecticut, in Indiana and in Florida. And in each of those cases, those laws were upheld. So they've been found to be constitutional. And the red flag law we have here in Wisconsin is modeled in part on other laws that we already have in place in Wisconsin, like domestic violence restraining orders. It's the same type of process, which is somebody needs to go to a judge and demonstrate that somebody presents a significant threat in the case of a domestic violence order, that there's a significant threat that they would commit an act of domestic violence. And in the case of a red flag law, it would be a significant threat that they would commit an act of violence with a firearm to themselves or to somebody else. So it's a process we already have in Wisconsin law. It's one that's been supported in other contexts. I think we need to move forward with it here to help save lives.
What steps are in place to protect due process if someone's firearms are taken away, they think unjustifiably, is there a recourse for them to go and ask the judge to change that decision?
Yes. Under the proposed red flag law, first of all, an order would have to be issued by a judge. So there would be a judge or a circuit court commissioner involved in the issuance of an order. There's also a limit on who can request that order. So it would either need to be requested by a law enforcement officer or by a family member or a household member. And then the initial order would be temporary. It would only last for up to 14 days. And then there would need to be a hearing. And at that hearing, and this is something else the speaker was incorrect about in his recent appearance on Upfront, the burden is not on the person whose firearm was taken. At that hearing, the burden is still on the person who's requesting the red flag order to show that that the order should be issued. And even if that order is issued, that then only lasts for up to a year. And the person whose firearms are at issue has the right to come back in and request that they have their rights fully restored during that one-year period. So there are a number of protections in place for lawful firearm owners here. And where the laws have been in place, they have been seemingly popular. They have remained in effect in all of the states where they've been passed. States haven't gone in the other direction.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jerry is with us in Racine. Jerry, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. In regards to your guest saying the majority are in support of red flag laws, I have yet to meet an individual who fully supports the red flag law, both sides of the aisle, whether they're Democratic or Republican. There's a big concern in regards to having a situation go on in a person's life, a divorce or something like that, and the spouse goes to the police department, files a complaint. He has firearms, and then they're taken from him, and then he has to come back and prove that he's a safe individual, that he shouldn't have his firearms taken away from him. And that never really works out the way it's always discussed. It says, oh, you could come back in 14 days. Well, when the rubber meets the road, Does the guy have to get a lawyer? Is that going to be more cost for that individual? How long will that court battle go? Things like that, and that's where people get worried about it. They don't want to see their shotguns and all their firearms being confiscated, and then they have to go there and fight to get them back.
Jerry, thanks for the call. Attorney General Call, what do you think?
Well, first of all, the process that is proposed in this law is one that's really reasonable. So the concerns that somebody, who gets into dispute with somebody might lead to somebody filing a petition. If somebody files a petition and they include a false statement, they would be subject to prosecution for a felony for making a false statement. So there are protections against that. Secondly, again, this process is similar to processes that already exist for things like a domestic violence restraining order. So it's got similar protections. And then third, the person doesn't need to prove that they are somebody who can safely protect possess a firearm. The burden would be on the people seeking to have the firearm removed. And it's a high standard to get the permanent injunction or the 1 year injunction. They would need to establish by clear and convincing evidence that the person, if they possess a firearm, is substantially likely to use it to injure another person. So there are strong protections in place. And as to public support, President Trump came out and said that he supports red flag laws shortly after we had the mass shootings in Dayton and El Paso. And, Marquette Law School polling indicates that about 81% of Wisconsinites support a red flag law. So there is strong support for this. And what we've seen before several acts of gun violence is that there are warning signs. In the case of the shooter in Parkland, there were contacts with law enforcement. This is meant to give law enforcement a tool to intervene when those clear signs of danger are present, and intervening can help prevent an act of violence. It's not meant to be a tool that can be used broadly in all sorts of cases. It would be used in all likelihood in a much more limited fashion, and that's how it's been used in the states where it is on the books.
Thanks for that call, Jerry. We're talking to Attorney General Josh Call right now about the special session held last week to address two new gun control measures in the State Assembly and Senate. Each of those sessions lasted basically less than a minute. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you think about last week's special session? What do you think about the idea of expanding background checks to include most private gun sales? How about the idea of a red flag law? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation with State Attorney General Josh Call. He's with us to talk about last week's special session to debate and vote on two gun control bills. Republican leaders in the Assembly and Senate adjourned the sessions quickly without debating the proposed measures. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think about what happened at that brief special session? Do you support the idea of expanding background checks to include more firearm sales from in private transactions? And what about the idea of red flag laws? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1-2-3-4. We'll go back to your calls now. Matthew is with us in St. Croix Falls. Matthew, hi.
Hey, how's it going, guys? So here's my thing is, all right, couple points. There's that kid down in Fenimore or down by Richland Center that shot up the Tenonite or whatever it's called. It wasn't Tenonite. Some sort of explosive with a rifle, and it was like 10 pounds of it. He shouldn't be able to be in the same room as a handgun ever again. I'm a hunter. I'm a fisher. I get it. I like guns, too. But, man, we need to reel this stuff in. There was a woman that shot through the KFC window because her order was wrong.
Matthew, thanks for the call. Matthew making the case, Attorney General Call, that some people should maybe lose their firearm rights permanently for some cases.
Yeah, and there are laws in place that if, for example, if somebody's been convicted of a felony, they are, not permitted in Wisconsin to have access to a firearm. And that's one of the, one of the things about these two changes that I think is important to emphasize is these are, moderate, careful measures that protect Second Amendment rights while also working to make our communities safer. In the case of somebody who's prohibited from possessing a firearm because they've committed a felony, for example, by expanding background checks, what we'd be doing is saying, we want to make sure a background check is conducted before that person or anybody else who's trying to buy a firearm is able to get a firearm. I don't think that person should be able to go online and buy a firearm without going through a background check.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Anthony now in Phelps. Anthony, hi.
Yes. I got a question, a statement about these background checks. The DOJ did a survey, and they found out that 46% of the guns used in crime are straw bought. 46% of the guns used in crime are either stolen or black market. 6% of the guns used are legally bought with background checks by first-time criminals. Less than 2% of the guns are bought without a background check. And if you try to go in, and the DOJ did this online, and tried to sell guns through without background checks, and they were shot down every time they made a contact. This thing about straw buying, a woman in Oklahoma.
Anthony, I'm going to jump in because we don't have a ton of time, but Anthony making the case that, hey, straw guns, stolen guns are a much bigger problem. I don't know about the particular statistics. This is a very small part of the story. He's worried these guns bought that get around background checks, Attorney General Call.
Well, Anthony's right that we do need to make sure that people are not engaging in straw purchases of firearms, and that is a way that crimes with firearms are sometimes committed. And I do think we need to make sure we're enforcing those laws effectively. But from my perspective, that's not a reason not to take what I think is the common sense step of making sure that we are requiring background checks for sales that right now we're not requiring them for. And you know, even if it's a small percentage of firearms crimes where that is how somebody's able to obtain a firearm, if we can save some lives by expanding background checks, I think we need to do that. And again, there are clear examples where people have avoided background checks and gotten guns that they're not allowed to buy that way, such as in the Azana Spa shooting in Brookfield.
Thanks for that call, Anthony. And I should say a straw buyer is someone who can buy a firearm, buying it for somebody who isn't supposed to be able to get it legally. Do we, and Wisconsin, I know, has been trying to tweak its straw buyer legislation for at least a couple decades now. Are there other changes you see, Attorney General Call, when it comes to that straw purchaser buying a gun for someone who shouldn't be able to get one?
Well, I think we always need to make sure that our laws are responding to the kinds of problems that we're facing. But generally speaking, there are clear and strong laws against straw purchases, and those laws should be enforced when people are violating them. And one of the things we do at the Wisconsin Department of Justice is we work to enforce a number of laws, but including laws that deal with illegal possession of firearms. And law enforcement around the state is working hard to make sure that those laws are enforced. But, earlier this year, I did a press conference in Appleton, along with the police chiefs from Appleton and Oshkosh and Wrightsville, as well as some local leaders up there. And, you know, they joined me in calling for red flag laws. As one of the officers pointed out, having an additional tool that law enforcement can use to intervene and try to prevent a tragedy is helpful to them and makes it easier for them to do their jobs of keeping our community safe.
Talking to Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call. We've been talking about gun laws in Wisconsin. I want to spend our last few minutes, though, Attorney General Call, on a lawsuit that Wisconsin joined in on challenging the Trump administration's so-called conscience rule. They would expand the ability of healthcare workers to refuse to provide certain services on moral or ethical grounds. A judge recently overturned those Trump administration rules. What are your thoughts on what the Trump administration was trying to do there?
Well, Wisconsin was part of that lawsuit, and we're one of the states involved in challenging this Trump administration policy. Wisconsin and many other states already have conscience protections in place so that our public policy balances the ability of patients to get the care that they need with the ability of medical providers to opt out of procedures that they have moral or religious objections to providing. We have a carefully balanced law here. One of the troubles with the Trump administration policy is that it's not carefully balanced. It sweeps very broadly. would at least, as it's written, theoretically allow somebody who's scheduling appointments to opt out of being involved in scheduling appointments if they didn't support the procedure that was being conducted. They wouldn't allow employers, medical providers, to ask about those objections in advance, so somebody at the last minute could decide to opt out, leaving somebody who needs care without ready access to care. And the consequences for a violation of the policy, not only by somebody who's receiving funds from the federal government, but by their subgrantees, are potentially enormous. The federal government could remove all federal funding for certain health programs to the state of Wisconsin. The judge in this case found for a variety of reasons that the Trump administration's policy was unlawful, and it struck it down, and that's a good thing for people who care about reliable access to health care coverage.
Do you anticipate an appeal where this might end up going to the U.S. Supreme Court?
I think it's quite likely that there will be an appeal, and how far it goes in the appeals process remains to be seen. But given how extreme this policy is, and given that there are parts of it that are, as the judge found in the ruling, that are inconsistent with statutes that are on the books, we have very strong legal arguments, and I think we will prevail on appeal.
As we wrap up, do you see any changes in the works for Wisconsin's version of these conscience clauses in just our last few moments?
I haven't heard any advocacy for policy changes on that front. It's one of the reasons that this Trump administration rule is so misguided, is because states have already put in place thoughtful, balanced rules to, again, both protect access to medical care, but also to protect people's rights to opt out of procedures that they're morally opposed to providing. So we have a thoughtful rule in place. The Trump administration rule tries to supersede Wisconsin's rule and the rules of other states and impose a federal solution that, again, is inconsistent with the law and would be bad for people who care about access to reliable healthcare services.
Attorney General Call, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Josh Call, Attorney General for the state of Wisconsin. He joins us to talk about last week's special session on gun control and a recent decision from a federal judge to void a Trump administration conscience clause rule. Wisconsin's one of 23 states, cities, and other entities to file a lawsuit challenging that rule. We'll take a closer look at that topic later on in the show with a Wisconsin healthcare expert and take your calls. Get ready for a serious dose of cold the next couple of days. On average, temperatures are typically in the 40s this time of year across Wisconsin, but we're not going to get close to that for at least the next few days. And it's not just Wisconsin. The National Weather Service says 148 daily record lows could fall this week across a good chunk of the country. So areas that got snow today, especially in southern and far northern Wisconsin, are going to be stuck with it for a while. The calendar's not wrong. It really is only November 11th. So what happened to fall, and what might actual winter have in store for us? Jonathan Erdman is a Milwaukee-based senior digital meteorologist with weather.com and a contributor to the Weather Channel podcast. John, good to have you back on Central Time.
It's great to be with you.
Now, I get Wisconsin, John. I generally don't allow myself to complain about snow in Wisconsin. Am I allowed to complain about repeated snow in November in Wisconsin?
Rob, I think we're going to have to give everybody a pass on the complaints right now. This is really something. To have had this much snow, this many days of snow so early in the season, before we even hit mid-November, is pretty impressive.
What's going on? Why are we getting so much autumn snow?
Well, Rob, the problem is you have to point up to the jet stream, first of all, and that's the general storm track of how weather systems move across the United States. And when the jet stream takes a really strong southward plunge into the central and western United States, generally that brings a lot of cold Canadian air southward, and that's certainly been the case in October and particularly over the last few weeks into November in the upper Midwest. And so that's brought the cold air, and then you bring the storm track right over that cold air, and you have a recipe for the rounds of snow that we've seen basically over the last 2 weeks.
So this stuff usually would have been rain if it weren't for this jet stream.
Yeah, usually so. There were some areas in general to the west of us, say over the Rockies and over the High Plains and say parts of, say, North Dakota that, October snow would be more typical. But unfortunately, this cold air has made it this far south and east so that what might normally be rain here ends up being snow. And you have what we have.
And Wisconsin is not the only place that's getting a taste of winter weather in the autumn, right? This is happening across a lot of the country.
Yeah, in fact, right now we're tracking one of the most impressive cold fronts for this time of year that we've seen in some time. That's going to bring hundreds of daily record lows through not just the Midwest, but also deep into the South, all the way to the Gulf Coast this week. And associated with that Arctic plunge, we're expecting accumulating snow as far south as Nashville, Tennessee, St. Louis and Cincinnati would be their first snow of the season. So, yeah, we're not alone in this. And in some of those areas, it's quite early for them.
What is pulling the strings on the jet stream? What determines how far south it goes?
Well, in this case, I think we have a couple of items in play. First and foremost, we have this northward bulge of the jet stream that's over the eastern Pacific Ocean or just off the west coast. If you remember hearing about the wildfires that we've seen in the last several weeks in California, that same pattern has been keeping California so dry. And what happens is when you bulge the jet stream north in one part of the world, to the east of that northward bulge, it has to dive south. So, the parts of the western United States will actually trend much warmer over the next few days because of that northward bulge of the jet stream. But because we're east of that, we get the cold and snowy part of that, that jet stream amplification, if you will. So we're just, we're just dealing with this cold and snow part of that jet stream pattern.
If it's happening like this so far, is this a sign of things to come throughout the winter, that it's going to be a particularly cold and snowy winter, or is this not a predictor?
Well, sometimes these persistent patterns can show up again and again and again over a certain winter period. Our seasonal forecasters with the weather company are thinking that it could be kind of a bookended winter here in the upper Midwest. In other words, obviously starting out cold and snowy, then we get a little bit of a respite, say in December, maybe into early January, and then say from late January through March, we could have another rather cold period of time, which sounds pretty familiar. That's basically what happened last year. We had a bit of a respite, and then all of a sudden we had the whole polar vortex cold outbreak in late January, and March and even April were frustratingly cold. So that seems to be the general thinking for this winter.
Talking to John Erdman, based in Milwaukee. He's a meteorologist with weather.com, looking at, you guessed it, the weather. Lots of snow, early snow here in Wisconsin. John, from the vantage point of Wisconsin, people might say, wait, what about global warming? Is this proof that it isn't really happening? We've got snow, cold weather in October, November?
Well, it seems pretty bizarre to say, but actually these type of cold outbreaks can still happen when the overall planet is warming. And the reason that's the case is, I remember earlier we were talking about the jet stream buckling north and south. In a warming climate, what the climate scientists are telling us is that we can expect more of these wacky, amplified roller coaster jet stream patterns. So while if you look at the planet's temperatures on any given day, you'll see there'll be areas that'll be warmer than average and colder than average. So there could be small pockets where their temperatures are colder than average, say over the Midwest, as we're seeing right now. But when you look at a global perspective of it, there's just an awful lot of temperatures warmer than average. So we can still get cold outbreaks and periods of snow like this, but that doesn't, That doesn't mean there isn't global warming going on. It's just that we happen to be one of the unlucky few that are seeing that cold right now.
Zooming back in on Wisconsin, we've got this cold snap happening now. What are you watching for over the next week or so with the Wisconsin weather?
Well, Rob, I like to give a little glimmer of advice. I don't want it to, if you're tired of cold and snow already, I like to give a little bit of good news here. So, we do have a little bit more light snow coming in on Wednesday. That should be lighter than what we've seen right now. But in general, the cold will very slowly ease off, we think, in the upper Midwest, including Wisconsin, starting early next week. So we should start to see some less cold air start to work its way from the northern plains. And we should really, this week will be the worst of it as far as, temperatures highs in the teens and 20s. Parts of Wisconsin Tuesday and Wednesday. But hopefully by next week, we should see that cold air ease off a bit from the kind of record cold that we're seeing this week.
And John, we saw some news from the National Weather Service that made us think of you, wanted to ask you about it. The Weather Service announced they're going to issue snow squall warnings, things like a tornado or severe thunderstorm warning. But for winter stuff, what's up with these new warnings?
Yeah, this is a really good idea that's been implemented by the Weather Service. And, you know, basically what a snow squall is think of a really brief period of maybe an hour of snow of whiteout conditions or almost whiteout conditions, heavy snow, and then it stops. That's called a snow squall. And the concern the Weather Service has, and we've seen this time and time again in other parts of the Ohio Valley Midwest over the years, is this snow squall may only produce, say, a dusting or maybe an inch of snow, but it comes down in such a quick burst that the visibility's lowered dramatically, so all of a sudden you can't see well on the roads. And if it does come down that heavily for just a short period of time, it can accumulate on the roads, and all of a sudden the roads become slick, and you get these chain reaction multi-car pileup accidents. So this is an effort by the Weather Service to say, well, okay, it may only be an inch of snow, but it could fall over an hour or two, and this could be dangerous to drive in. So if you hear of a snow squall warning, the best thing to do is just delay your travel if you can, or just pull well off the road, go get something to eat maybe, and just kind of wait it out until that snow squall passes.
And John, as we wrap up, last week was Winter Weather Awareness Week here in Wisconsin. That would usually be out ahead of the winter weather. It came a little late this year, it turned out. But any basic thoughts on how we can keep safe with this and future snowstorms?
Yeah, I think the bottom line is, and it's real simple advice, is when you're driving, just slow down. Just increase your following distance with the car in front of you. You know, you can be 30 seconds or a minute late to whatever you need to be, or even much longer than that. So, you know, just slow down. Leave your following distance greater between the vehicle ahead of you. And then as far as forecasts are concerned, snowfall forecasts can change, as you probably noticed, from the time where you first hear it's going to snow, three or four days from now, up to the time where it begins to snow. So check back with your forecast, either through local media or your National Weather Service, for updates on the snowfall forecast, because that can change.
John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Jonathan Erdman is a Milwaukee-based senior digital meteorologist with weather.com and a contributor to the Weather Channel podcast. We talked to them about the early start to winter we've been experiencing in Wisconsin and what it could mean for the actual winter season coming up. When you file your taxes each year, there's a good chance you could do it for free under programs run by private companies. The Internal Revenue Service is responsible for regulating free tax filing programs, but new reporting from ProPublica shows the tax industry had a big hand in crafting the most recent round of rule changes. Tax companies have spent more than a decade lobbying the IRS for less oversight. At the same time, participation in their free tax filing programs has declined to just 3% of eligible Americans. Justin Elliott is a reporter for ProPublica. He's been covering this story. Justin, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be here.
Let's start with the basics of this free tax filing. We can't just go on to the IRS website and open up a form there and fill out our taxes. We have to go through a private company, right?
Yeah, right. And that's actually a distinction between the U.S. and a lot of other developed companies that exist, because these companies, the biggest one is Intuit, which makes TurboTax, have for years fought the IRS making its own free option. So instead, we have this public-private partnership called Free File, where the companies are supposed to offer free tax filing rather than the government.
How does this free tax filing system work? We can get referred there by the IRS website. In effect, we have to go through Intuit or one of these other companies.
Right. So how it's supposed to work is that if you make below the income threshold, which is $66,000 last year, if you manage to find the right IRS website and then choose the correct commercial offering, then you can file your taxes for free. What our reporting has found is that fewer and fewer people are using this option every year, and that's good for the companies like Intuit, the maker of TurboTax, because it means they have more paying customers.
Talk about what happens when somebody who's eligible to free file ends up going to one of these companies and finds themselves paying for this service they thought was free.
Well, basically what happens usually is just that the, you know, the company's profits swell. I mean, Intuit, this company based in Silicon Valley that makes TurboTax, their share price has been soaring. The founder is a billionaire. We obtained documents from the company showing that they know that even when people are expecting their tax return to be free, often it's not. And that's sort of essentially core to the business model. This public-private partnership with the IRS has essentially not been fulfilling its goals for many years now, and the IRS so far has basically done nothing about that.
And late last year, a group of experts called the IRS Advisory Council reviewed this program, the Free File Program, wrote up a report. It was about to come out, pretty critical. What happened next when it comes to this from the tax providers who provide these services?
Right. So this body of outside experts was actually asked by the IRS, take a look at this program. Is it working? The draft of this report was done. And what it said was, the IRS has completely failed to properly oversee this program. And, you know, lower income taxpayers who should be able to file for free are not getting that service. And it's a problem. So right before this expert report comes out, the emails we got show that the tax prep industry, including TurboTax, Intuit, got the IRS to extend the life of this program for another year, essentially preempting this criticism. And they, from what we can tell, the industry basically wrote the new deal with no significant input from the IRS, which I think shows the power relationship here.
And getting these emails wasn't a gimme. You filed information requests. The IRS initially pushed back, it sounds like.
Yeah. So, I mean, I originally filed a public records request way back in the spring of this year. The IRS said, we're not going to give you these documents. We sued. And only after we went to federal court did the agency cough up the documents. And what they showed, again, was that the industry here, especially Intuit, seemed to essentially be calling the shots for this program that the IRS is supposed to be overseeing.
Right. You couldn't find a lot of difference between what the industry groups were proposing in these emails and what the IRS eventually came out with?
Exactly right. So the industry lobbyist sends a bunch of proposed changes. Then a couple weeks later, the IRS and the industry signed the new deal. It reflects all of the proposed changes from the industry and nothing else that might help consumers actually use this program or find it. And then a couple weeks after that, this harshly critical report comes out. But by that point, the program has already been extended. So, they can't renegotiate it.
Talking to Justin Elliott, reporter for ProPublica, about the IRS and free tax filing that's provided through companies like Intuit. And it's been getting harder for people eligible for it to actually get free online tax filing. Justin, you looked at how companies like Intuit design their free tax system. Do you get the impression, do you get the sense that there's intent, that they're intentionally making it so that that person who comes on to file for free ends up finding themselves taking a paid service of some sort?
Absolutely. And I talked to many people that had worked at Intuit, TurboTax, literally on this issue. So a major part of the business model is you advertise free. Some people may remember the ad campaign last year was literally just people saying the word free over and over again and no other words. And so you get people starting filing their taxes. You know, most of us don't look forward to going through all of our tax forms and filling these things out. And then maybe halfway or three quarters of the way through the process, for many people who have clicked on free, the software will have a window pop up saying, actually, to file form X or Y, you're going to have to pay $60 and then another $50 for your state return. So you end up paying over $100. And what the company realized through, you know, very rigorous data testing is that many people hate filing their taxes so much that even if they thought they were going to get it for free, if you tell them when they're halfway through that they have to pay, they're just going to do it anyways because they don't want to have to start over again. So that's core to the whole business model of TurboTax.
Now, have you heard anything from the companies themselves, especially Intuit, in defense of their free file practices?
Yeah, sure. So the company, has basically stood by its business practices. They say that, that this all just reflects consumer choice and that, you know, they're sort of appropriately telling people what their options are and people are free to walk away if they want. They've actually been sued now in a private class action in California and also by some state entities, and they're vigorously contesting those lawsuits. So some of this might end up in court, and we don't know what will happen.
You've got a follow-up piece since your piece came out of tax filers reporting that they went to Intuit and said, hey, I should have been eligible for free filing but wasn't. I want my money back. What kind of results have they been getting?
Yeah, sure. So after this was after tax filing season this past year, people were calling to get refunds. Initially, TurboTax was actually giving refunds, but then there was a change in policy and they started saying no, and people were no longer getting their money back. Again, some of those people have now sued and that litigation is ongoing. But what we're looking for now is what will happen in this upcoming tax season next year, and whether any of this will change or whether we're going to see a repeat of what's happened in past years.
Big picture, is anybody making the case that we should be able to go to IRS.gov and file our own taxes without going through some separate private company?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, in many other wealthy countries, the tax agency uses the data that they already have to pre-fill your tax return, and then you look it over, and just click submit if it looks good to you. Elizabeth Warren has introduced a bill that would create a better government option. Bernie Sanders has come out for that as well. This is something that the industry has fought going back all the way back to the 90s. But in the meantime, for next year, if people are looking for a free version, try Googling IRS free file and going to the official IRS.gov site. It's a little bit hard to navigate, but if you make under $66,000, you should be able to file for free if you go to the correct place. And we hope to have more on that on our website next year.
And are there any changes, briefly as we wrap up, Justin, any changes expected from the IRS when it comes to oversight of how these private companies operate free file?
The jury's still out on that. The IRS Inspector General is conducting an audit of all this right now. So we're actually waiting to hear from the IRS whether they're going to try to beef up oversight or somehow make this more accessible to consumers.
Justin, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
That's Justin Elliott, reporter at ProPublica. He talked with us about the tax industry's efforts to shape the regulations for their free tax filing programs, an effort he says was successful based on emails obtained from the IRS. Want to hear from you. Have you ever tried to use free online tax filing, maybe even going from the IRS.gov website and finding a participating partner? Did you find it to be a simple process? Did you start out thinking you were filing for free and hitting a snag where you had to use a paid service or start the whole process from scratch? Did you end up giving up and paying for it? Did you end up being able to file for free online? Would you like to see the IRS offer free public tax filing program directly through their own website? Let us know what you've run into and what you think. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org, or you can always contact us on Twitter. We are @CentralTimeWPR. Love to hear your story. Yesterday marks the 50th anniversary of the first airing of a show that public media fans might remember, Sesame Street, 50 years old today. A lot of people have fond memories, including Keeley Boltina, WPR host. Hey, Keeley.
Hi, Rob.
Now, you have a special memory from your own childhood, right? This is not as a parent, but as a kid.
No, this is as a kid. Uh-huh. My grandparents recorded the special Follow That Bird on VHS tape.
This is the Big Bird movie.
This is the Big Bird movie where he's blue for a while. He runs away from home. Huge headliners like Candy, right? Chevy Chase, Dave Thomas, 1985. And there was a time where they let me watch it, and then it would be the end of it, and they would hit rewind, and I would watch it again, and it would be the end of it, and we would hit rewind, and you can see how this is going.
And this is, I mean, and I can attest, this is a formative part of your identity, Follow That Bird.
Absolutely.
You wouldn't be who you were.
No, and I admit, Oscar the Grouch opens this, and I can sing the anthem even to this day. I mean, I'm not going to do it, but I can, promise.
Yeah, we're short on time. Is this something you watch with your own kids? Have your own kids witnessed the splendor of Follow That Bird on VHS?
I haven't, but I do have the VHS tape, and it's part of the plan.
And you have something to play a VHS tape on?
Look into it.
All right. Thanks, Keeley.
Thanks, Rob.
This is Central Time.